This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
As the news of coronavirus reverberates throughout the world, we at HRN are especially concerned about how coronavirus will impact our food system. We will use our platform to support the restaurant, agriculture, hospitality, and other food-related industries by maintaining our coverage and operations. As social distancing becomes the temporary norm, podcasts are more important than ever. There's never been a more crucial time to stay informed about the state of our food system and the way that food connects our global community. We're sharing all of our COVID-19 coverage at heritageradionetwork.org/COVID-19. From interviews with nonprofit leaders and journalists to firsthand accounts from chefs and restaurant owners, to reports on how the crisis is affecting regional farms. Our team is working remotely from all over to keep food radio alive. HRN needs your support more than ever to keep sharing essential stories and resources with our listeners. Make a donation of any amount. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection of food and grief with your hosts, Zara Jangora and Bobby Comporto. Hey guys, how you doing out there? Crazy time, rough time, interesting time, enlightening time, painful time in a multitude of different ways. We're seeing some really crazy and disturbing things. We're seeing some really encouraging and beautiful things. It is an extreme emotional roller coaster. And we just want to remind you guys all, I was going to say re-extend, but I'm not sure if that's a word. So remind all of you that if anybody needs a little extra emotional support during this time, please feel free to reach out to us. processing@heritageradionetwork.org is the email address, or processing podcast on Instagram. And we'd love to hear from you if you just have something you want to share personally off air, or if you have a listener letter that you'd like us to read on the air, or you'd like to potentially be a guest, or you know a good guest. We'd love to hear from you, so please reach out. On today's show, we have a wonderful guest, Jenny Indig. And Jenny, we wanted to air this episode this week specifically because Mother's Day is coming up, and Jenny lost her mom 8 years ago to cancer. And it was a very touching interview, as most of our interviews are. But you know, because Bobby and I are mother and daughter, it was particularly, I don't know, it was complicated to listen to it and just experience that conversation. It was really challenging for me. I'll speak for myself, but I know it was for Bobby too. And I know it was for Jenny. It was very emotional. Jenny and her mom are very close. And we just thought this was a good episode to air for Mother's Day because, you know, we are accustomed to seeing the kind of Hallmark element of the holiday, people getting to celebrate their moms, which is so awesome and great to have a mom to celebrate with. But there's a lot of people who either had, strained relationships with their moms or that have lost their moms. And it can be a really triggering and difficult day. I can speak for myself on Father's Day, having lost my dad. I know that that is very hard. And similarly, I think it can be hard for people who have complicated or absent relationships with their moms. So yeah, that's why we wanted to play this episode today, and to honor Jenny and to honor her relationship with her mom. And she was just such a wonderful, wonderful guest. You can check out Jenny's blog, brooklynbalbosta.com. Great food blog. She's a great writer. She does a lot of writing for Brooklyn-based. And you can also check her out at brooklynbalbosta on Instagram. So we hope you are all staying safe and taking care of yourselves and each other. And please enjoy our conversation with Jenny. Okay, thanks. Bye. All right, so we're here with Jenny Indig. Jenny, hi.
Hi.
So nice to talk with you. We met, I guess, probably like 6 months ago, maybe a little longer now, at an HRN event. And I remember, like, after you reached out, how nice it was to meet you. You have such a warm smile, and you're such, like, a lovely person. And it was such a nice meeting then, and it's really great to have you back and have you on the show.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's such an honor to be with both of you.
Yeah. So, in learning a little bit about you, you mentioned that you were from Chicago originally, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Bobby and I have both lived in New York our whole lives. Grew up in Long Island, both of us. I've lived in Brooklyn for a long time. So I really don't have a great picture of what it's like to grow up in the Midwest. And I'm actually just curious to get a better idea of you. Like, how did that inform you in terms of the person you are today? How was it different growing up in Chicago?
Well, I mean, the best visual image I can kind of conjure up is think of any John Hughes movie, 16
right.
Candles, Home Alone. I mean, that those were all filmed in the towns around where I grew up. So I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, not the city.
Right.
I don't know. It was just a really, you know, warm, loving place to grow up. I went to a, you know, big public high school. My parents were both clinical psychologists who worked in the town that I grew up in.
Oh. They had a private practice?
They had a private practice together, which was really nice. Yeah, you know, I grew up in a small town, you know, that fed into a much larger high school. But
right.
it was a wonderful place to grow up.
Right. Well, I'm curious what it was like to have two parents that are psychologists.
I know how much how it's interesting to have one. I was actually curious about that too.
Yeah.
No, people always joke. I mean, I have myself and a younger sister and brother, and you know, typically children of therapists always end up some type of psychological disorders. But I think the three of us ended up pretty well adjusted. We're an incredibly close family. And I think that's 100% a testament to how my parents raised us. So
yeah. Were they open people?
Oh, yeah. There were no secrets in my family. I mean, there's still not. There's no such thing as a secret. You know, you tell one person and within 5 minutes, it's been transmitted to every member of the family. So,
yeah. Well, I'm curious, something that from reading some stuff that you talked to us about before this interview, having two psychologist parents in Chicago, you grew up in like the late 80s, early 90s, mm-hmm. kind of. Did that kind of put you apart? Just did you feel different than maybe some of your friends? Did you feel like maybe, you know, because like being from a home, I can just speak for myself, but you're like a little bit more open. You're kind of thinking a little differently. Was your family very different than other families?
I think so. I mean, I think I didn't realize how different it was until I moved away and kind of learned about what other people's experiences were like in their, you know, childhood home. You know, again, it was we shared everything. Yeah. I mean, I think we were, I don't know. I don't want to say like more warm and open, but it was definitely like a, you know, everyone loved coming over to our house. My parents were kind of friendly with all of my friends growing up. You know, they were strict. They were tough. It wasn't like a anything goes kind of place. They, you know, put a lot of pressure on us to do well in school and to, you know, I was a competitive athlete. And I think they, you know, instilled in us this, like, work hard kind of sentiment. And, but I think, I don't know if it was different, but being, you know, it's interesting that I've never moved back.
Yeah.
I kind of went away to school on the East Coast and, you know, just aside from my family, there was just never a lot pulling me back. And I felt like the bonds that I had to both my parents and my siblings were strong enough that geography wasn't, you know, reason enough to move back home. But that's been a hard decision that I've struggled with for a long time, and I think finally have made peace with making home here in New York and in Brooklyn. But for a long time, it was, you know, hard for me to imagine, you know, raising a family myself without having my own family around.
Of course, absolutely. And, you know, I kind of am asking, like, the questions about your upbringing, and especially with your parents' professions and where you grew up, because I think that sometimes these things of like what your parents did and how we grew up, like you don't necessarily realize it in the moment, right? So you're 13 or you're 15 or you're 18 or you're 7 and your parents are just your parents. They are just the way they are. But then you kind of come to be an adult and you go through certain things. And then I think it sets in then sometimes.
In reflection.
Right. That like, oh, I'm going deeper or I'm feeling this in a certain way or that a certain circumstance has happened to where now the way I'm coping with it is really interesting, right? And I think interestingly enough, those can be the same things that make you feel maybe other or different, right? Like growing up, so like, oh, my parents are both psychologists, and people think that's weird. My mom's an accountant, and my dad's a fireman, you know?
Well, I have one thought about that. You know, I don't know if anyone's familiar with the book by Daniel Goleman called Emotional Intelligence. He also wrote Social Intelligence.
No, I haven't heard of
it. I think that emotional intelligence is an interesting concept. It has nothing to do with our intellect per se, but it has to do with our discussing of emotions, experiencing of emotions,
right,
and awareness of emotions. So I would imagine that with your parents, that you learned from them emotional intelligence. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think completely. And I think, you know, you're right. I think things that I take for granted, like the fact that I'm a very transparent person who shares a lot about myself, sometimes too much. But, you know, I think that when growing up, kind of a sign or a testament to if someone was like a quote-unquote good person or someone that you would, you know, a good friend was, well, you know, did they ask questions? You know, and I think that that was a big thing that my parents kind of taught me, and I didn't really realize until much later in life that that's just a, you know, it's a general way of being, of just being curious about other people.
That's a very good point.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is such a, asking questions of other people, I noticed that immediately in people. You know, if I meet a new person, a new friend, or a new partner that I'm maybe a guy I'm going to date, and they don't ask questions, as I get older, I'm so keyed into that, because it's someone's curiosity about you and about life is such a good sign. You know, it's such a green flag.
Yeah.
What was the cooking situation like in your house growing up?
So it's interesting. It wasn't, you know, my mom and dad both, you know, because of their private practice, often had to work evenings. And so dinner very much was an afterthought for, you know, the majority of my childhood. You know, we had a babysitter who took care of us on the nights that my mom worked late. And then she would be home, you know, I think like Wednesday, Thursday night. But it was often like we ate a lot of McDonald's, I have to say. It was like coming home from like some kind of practice, picking up food. It wasn't something that she, and I think she felt guilty about it growing up. I think it was always something she wished she did better, was like meal prep, or it just wasn't something that she enjoyed thinking about. She was an extremely talented woman. She, you know, did everything, but cooking was just not, you know, it wasn't something that brought her a lot of pleasure. And so she just didn't think about it until it was too late, until we were eating like mac and cheese for dinner. So I think at a certain point, I don't know if it was in high school or even earlier, like I started kind of cooking and cooking for my sister and brother and like making our lunches, because lunch was often just like pulling sleeves of Ritz crackers and stuffing.
What kind of stuff would you make?
I don't even remember what it started with. I think just following recipes and then like kind of teaching myself, I guess like stir fries or I don't even remember what it was.
So the interest was brewing.
Yeah. And I think it just, again, it became a way for me to, as the oldest sibling, kind of pitch in and take care of my younger siblings. And it's kind of like, well, if it was something I cared about, then no one else was doing it. And then, you know, eventually my dad kind of became more interested. I think he like fell in love with Giada when she got on the Food Network and started like following her recipes.
Who amongst us didn't?
So he became more of like the in-house, you know, chef, but that was a little bit later.
Did your mom enjoy to eat? Did she enjoy eating?
She did. She did. And you know, it's interesting. She wasn't like a home cook and wasn't an everyday cook, but she loved, like, she still loved hosting and entertaining. So she would spend a lot of, they would plan these like elaborate dinner parties, and, you know, whether it was for, they had a few people that worked for them in their private practice, so they would have them, you know, over every quarter, or like family celebrations and Jewish holidays. So a lot of thought was put into those kind of events. You know, she would write out these long, elaborate meal cards and kind of test different recipes. But it was more the act of that.
Of giving.
Of giving.
And creating. You say she was creative.
Oh,
what other
goodness.
Kinds of things did she
If you could DIY anything, my mom could do it. I mean, if you had the option to buy it at a store or do it yourself, she would always, I mean, whether it was my sister was a competitive ice skater, so she sewed all of her costumes. Aww. I mean, our Halloween costumes. You know, I think back to our wedding. She did. She hand crocheted 150 yarmakis.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing.
Yeah. And she derived, like, so much. You know, I look back at the pictures, and I'm like, well, they do look a little. You know, everything is a little bit handmade. But
That's amazing.
She really, and she loved every, it was a real labor of love for her. I mean, that was her way of expressing her love and how much she cared for, you know, people around her.
Right, making it nice.
Yep.
Actually, we always have a funny little story that we tell. I was similar to your mom in that I was never extremely talented, but I really wanted to make things. And one year I made Zara's graduation costume. I think she was in she was in fifth grade.
It was a Christmas thing because I remember that it was like red and white because it was a Christmas play or something like that. I think I was in fourth grade.
So as Zara knows, I never follow rules, and so I didn't have any pattern or anything. I figured I can do this myself. And when I put the fabric, I thought I found this silky satiny fabric. I didn't realize it was lining. So I made it. It came out okay. It was a little off, you know, but it was okay, you know. And Zara got on stage, and the minute she raised her hands, all the seams tore.
The sleeves fell off. Right off the dress.
So but we love that.
It really is the thought that counts.
And
it's
I appreciate
sweet,
what you said about your mom.
Yeah, it really is sweet. And, you know, the thing I think, right, about people who love food, love cooking, love celebrating, like, it really isn't about the thing, because that's so subjective. Everyone has a different thing that they like. A Twinkie could be just as amazing as a homemade eclair to anyone, right? So it's not about the actual thing. It's about what it brings to you and what it brings to the people around you, and it says something about people who really enjoy celebrating, you know? Not that they're better or worse than anyone else, but they have a certain something in them that wants to, you know, bring other people up. You know, you just have the urge to reach out and make other people happy through celebration. It's really special. Yeah. It's a wonderful quality.
She was also a master of, she just liked to master different projects. Like, if there was something that she didn't know how to do but could learn, she also was, an avid consumer of, learning. I think she just loved, learning new skills and learning how to do something, and that process of kind of conquering a new skill.
What is your mom's first name?
Shelley.
So you moved from Chicago then to New York, 15 years ago?
I moved to the, I went to school in college in upstate New York. Over 20 years ago.
Okay.
And then kind of stayed on the East Coast, lived in Washington, D.C. for a few years, and then ended up meeting my husband kind of a few years after that, actually up in the Catskills at some resort.
Oh, cool.
It was a young Jewish professionals retreat.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, we were both dragged to it kind of by respective friends, and started dating right after that, and did long distance for a little while. And, he had just moved to New York and started a company here. And, you know, the joke kind of was, well, as long as he's running this company, we'll, you know, stay in New York. And he's still running the company, so we're still here.
And you worked originally not in food, because now we're going to get to it later, but now you have this amazing blog, and you write about food, and your life is very much in food, and your profession is very much in food. But you were originally working in counterterrorism, correct?
Yeah. So my background, I studied international relations kind of all throughout college, and my first job out of college was working at a think tank in Washington, D.C., doing foreign policy and national security related issues. And it was just, it's that story of one thing leads to another. I had really great mentors who were kind of at the forefront of counterterrorism, and it was shortly after 9/11. It's just, I ended up going to grad school to study it further, and then coming back to New York again because I wanted to be here. Finding, doing that type of work here, there's not as many jobs as there would be in Washington, D.C., so I ended up working for the NYPD for a long time.
Wow.
As an intelligence analyst.
That's amazing, and I'm actually, on a sidebar, curious about that, if we could just kind of shift to that for a second, about how working in that field, and working in such a high-stress environment, and being someone who loves also celebrating and food and these kind of, very rich, pleasures in life, butting up against a very kind of harsh work life. How did that all mesh together?
Yeah, I mean, I think it actually complemented each other really well. I mean, I think for me, the food and the cooking and coming home and kind of spending the day thinking about what I wanted to cook for dinner.
So while you were thinking of counterterrorism, you were thinking.
Exactly. I probably spent too much time thinking about food while I was supposed to be thinking about counterterrorism. Actually, I don't know. I mean, I could probably see this now, but our office, it was an undisclosed location, but very close to Chelsea Market for a long time. It's not there anymore. So I would always strategically, I'd be sitting at my desk kind of trying to do work, but thinking about how I could strategically, like, take my lunch break and pick up all the ingredients I wanted for dinner.
That's great.
That is great. It's good balance.
Yeah.
Because I'm always curious about that. And, like, I have a real desire to talk to, like, first responders and people who work in that kind of field, because it's so interesting to me. Like, my life has been in food, so it's very natural for me to think about eating in a way that's very, like, organic. And I don't mean organic vegetables, just, like, it's seamless, you know? And I don't mean seamless the delivery side. But I think it's interesting about how when people do things that are really high stress, where does food play in? And it makes a lot of sense that it could be like kind of a diffuser. I feel like I'm speaking in a lot of puns right now, kind of like it could be like diffusing a bomb. No, but that's interesting.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the field of, again, it wasn't anything that I was never like, I want to work for the CIA. I want to be a counterterrorism analyst. It was just, it was kind of a career that just kind of fell on my lap. I mean, if you had... You had to ask. I probably should have ended up becoming a therapist like my parents. It was just, I almost did it in like, I don't know if it was defiance, but I wanted to do anything but that.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of being an intelligence analyst and especially, you know, in the field of terrorism, I think a lot of it is just, is first of all, you know, trying to figure out why people make certain decisions and why people... individuals, you know, take a certain path or what the drivers of radicalization are. And, you know, there's a lot of psychology that goes into that. So absolutely. I think that that's the part of the job that I really enjoyed the most.
Yeah.
You know, like asking those types of questions. And
yeah, it's fascinating. It's actually interesting you mentioned that because I had just listened to an episode of Armchair Expert the other day with Chris Voss.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's it was just talking about negotiating because he was a hostage negotiator for the FBI. And it was really fascinating. You know, it's just something I hadn't thought about. But, like, the psychology behind it is incredible. It's so psychologically based. It's, like, wild. So it's not, yeah, it's not surprising you went into that.
Yeah.
So then where did food come in?
So food, I mean, again, so I had kept this blog. I mean, it must have been, I don't know, probably, like, yeah, probably 2007, 2008. I write when blogging kind of even started. And, again, it was just a way for me to, like, I enjoy cooking and entertaining and hosting so much. And it was just a way for me to kind of document and honestly share with my family, with my mom, kind of whatever recipes. You know, I was really, I was proud of it. I knew it wasn't something that everyone enjoyed doing, especially in a city like New York where, you know, my apartment was tiny. We, you know, for a long time didn't have a dishwasher, but you know, you do it.
Sure.
And, you know, so just trying to make it, like, accessible and easier for, you know, trying to encourage other people to do it, too. That was kind of the purpose of it.
So it was mostly about your home cooking.
Yeah, about my home cooking. It's wonderful. It wasn't, you know, just little anecdotes. And I always felt this, you know, was a weird, I felt a little bit weird about having a public profile, like, working in intelligence.
Totally.
So I didn't do a lot to promote it. I didn't, you know, this was even way before Instagram. So, you know, there was nothing like that. But I felt conflicted about it. So I kind of, I did it, but didn't put a lot of time into it. And then, you know, fast forward, I had a really interesting career. I'd ended up, you know, leaving the NYP. I did a stint in the private sector. And then kind of ended up back at a think tank here in New York. And, you know, about a year ago, just decided to, like, spend more time on it. It was, again, I found myself wanting and, like, thinking more about food than... you know, ISIS or, you know, what.
Sure.
And I, so I just started, and I started writing more. I think I use it as a way to kind of explore different topics and kind of use it as like a way to write some more personal essays. And I found that I really enjoyed it and I was getting some good feedback from, you know, I think really not only my friends and family read it, but, I was able to find my voice in my writing in a way that I had never done so in my career.
I'm thinking of a line from Mary Oliver when she says, love what you love. And that's what it reminds me that you, you needed to move towards that.
Yeah.
And love what loves you back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee, representing 75% of U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry production. With over 100 articles published in health journals stating the vast health benefits of Michigan's superfruit, it's best to choose the cherry with more. U.S. Montmorency Tart Cherries. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency Tart Cherry at choosecherries.com.
in between this time, you know, you actually going back to your writing, you had sent me something that you wrote, and kind of in between this time of like now and when we're talking about your work life and moving to New York, something happened in your life that kind of changed everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us a little bit about what your kind of, you know, you told us about your family growing up, and can you tell us a little bit about what your family kind of structure is like now and this event?
Sure. So, you know, as I mentioned, I, you know, have an incredibly close family. You know, it's the type of family where I, you know, each of us talk to each other on the phone, I mean, multiple times a day. You know, my brother's on the West Coast, my sister's still in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But there's not a day that goes by that we're not all in touch with each other. And it was shortly, about, I guess, a year or so after my husband and I got married. You know, we were living in Brooklyn. I think it was, I was about to turn 30, so I was like 29. And I get a call from my mom. I was actually at work, working for the NYPD. And, you know, I had this sixth sense about my mom. I don't know where I've always felt like this. We look so much alike. We have like a very similar body type, a very similar personality. And for about, you know, 6 months, she had been complaining about night sweats. And I just had this, you know, weird, she was someone who never went to the doctor. Like, she just never needed to. She was extremely healthy. She was athletic. I'd never really, you know, been sick before. She had like a stint of breast cancer like years and years ago, but you know, it was stage one and she was fine and she survived that. But, you know, I get a call from her at work, and she had gone to see her internist, and her intern, you know, fast forward, it turns out she had stage 4 kidney cancer.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I remember, I have this, like, vivid memory, and this is such a New York story, of just, you know, I was in a meeting. I got the call from my dad. I knew what was happening. You know, I left the meeting, picked it up. You know, they told me what the diagnosis was. And I kind of held it together at work. And I remember walking out of Chelsea Market towards the train back to Brooklyn, and I just, like, started sobbing like that, you know, the kind that just doesn't stop. And, you know, I was like, thank God for New York. Like, this is the only city where you can kind of just do that and get on the train and go home.
Space and, for everything.
Yeah. There's space for that too.
Yeah. Kind of hidden in plain sight.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it was a shock. I mean, it was one of those things where, you know, I don't think that even like with that kind of diagnosis, there's just not a lot of options. And even that, I mean, that was 8 years ago, nine years ago, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so we just, you know, for a while, she, like, my mom made the decision to, like, not tell anyone. She didn't want her patients to know. So I think for about a month, there was a month period of time where, you know, I wasn't really allowed to tell anyone. You know, I told my husband and obviously, like, maybe my closest friends, but Glencoe, the town that I grew up in, was, like, such a small community that it was really important to my parents and especially my mom that, you know, stayed between us for a while. So, you know, you kind of carried that around.
Makes it a heavier load.
Yeah, really heavy.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think I sent you these pictures during that time. My family has a house outside of Whistler.
Yeah, really beautiful.
It's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, it's like it's a dream. Yeah. And we decided to all go there, like, I don't know, it was like 3 weeks after she was diagnosed. And I hired our photographer from our wedding to take these pictures.
Oh,
and
that's so special. I can't wait to see them.
Yeah, they're beautiful. They're really special. But there's this picture of us kind of at the, it was, the lake was frozen, but there's a lake in the backyard, and we all, I don't know, kind of, it was the middle of the afternoon, but we had a bottle of champagne and kind of all toasted to life. And it was really, you know, that moment where we didn't know, really didn't know what lay ahead of us, didn't know how, had no idea really how long my mom had left to live, but we're just like enjoying the moment and each other. And I felt so grateful for that. And the photos too, because it was really, when I think about it, my mom, I mean, she declined so quickly physically that it was the last photos that we had of her where she really looked like herself too. So
I can't wait to see those photos. Yeah. Will we be able to, are we going to post them somewhere?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
So, yeah, I'm just kind of struck by that feeling that I think a lot of us have experienced. And you kind of really describe it so beautifully and candidly of that moment when you just kind of realize that life has changed. It's so weird. And I think we all kind of walk around really being afraid of it and putting it so in the back of our minds. You know, that happens to other people, or that's somebody else's family, or this kind of thing can't happen to me. And then when it does, it's, in my experience at least, and I want to know if you agree with this, it's oddly both way more scary and upsetting and not at all as you would have ever thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And I just think from the beginning, I think my mom and dad kind of made the decision that they didn't want, like, our life was so good and we were so lucky, and just wanted us to keep living. Yeah. And, you know, like, in the 15 months that my mom lived after her diagnosis, like, we never talked about death. Like, not once. At least, you know, I think she had those private conversations with my dad, but at least with myself and my sister and brother, like, it wasn't something she was willing to face. You know, she would talk about treatment, but she was much more interested in, you know, what was going on in our lives. And I think...
She wanted to be.
She wanted to be, and she wanted to live. And I think, you know, in that time, you know, my husband and I had been married. I think, you know, I had like a age in my head where I was like, okay, when I turn 30, I want to start having kids. But, you know, we had this conversation and I was like, you know, if there's a chance that we could get pregnant and I could have a baby, while my mom's still alive, like, let's do it. And, you know, he was 100% supportive. And I think, I don't know if I told my mom right away, but I think when I did, she just, like, started crying. And I think, like, seeing how happy that made her, the idea of, like, bringing another life into this world, you know, that she could meet.
And being able to see your child.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we were really, really lucky. I think I got pregnant, like, 3 months later. Wow. But that was hard, too, because I knew, you know, I just didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what her treatment plan would look like. I didn't know if I'd be able to see her being pregnant while she was going
really
through certain
walking into the unknown every day.
So that was scary.
All of you.
But it was 100% like the best decision we ever made. And I'm so grateful she was able to meet my daughter, and, you know, I can
absolutely
share part of that story, but it was, you know, also experiencing, you know, being pregnant while she was alive and being able to ask her questions and, you know, and it was always like the mundane.
And her being able to answer them.
Yeah.
It must have meant so much to her.
And, you know, everything from like picking out furniture for the nursery or, you know, it was like the little things that I just, you know, you take for granted now, but I just, you know.
So you could pass that by her. Was she able to be with you, or it was more of you talking with her on the phone?
Yeah, mostly on the phone. Yeah. I mean, I tried to go back to Chicago. I mean, I stayed in New York. Again, it was like there's no timeline. I think that's the hardest thing.
You had no handbook for this, any of you.
I knew the date, you know, the baby was due, and that was it. That was like the only date on the calendar and nothing else, you know, up until when someone, you know, gets hospital. You just don't even know, like, how a treatment plan's going to look like or how someone's going to respond to treatment. So that was also, I think, just focusing on what we knew was coming. And I think... early on, you know, I think after my husband and I had decided, like, that it would be a really, you know, really amazing to have, you know, my mom there. She never said, like, oh, can I be there?
At the birth.
Birth. But at a certain point, you know, we said to her, like, if you're able to travel and want to be there, we'd love to have you there. I didn't have a doula. Yeah. I didn't have, you know, any kind of, like, birth plan or anything like that. But, I knew that if she could be there, that I really, you know, that would be so special and meaningful. And I couldn't imagine another person in the world besides my husband who could, you know, keep me calm in a moment like that. So she did. She was, you know, my daughter was due in November, and my mom flew out about a week, you know, before she was due. And
what was her condition at that time?
She was very weak. Mm-hmm. She was in a lot of pain. She had lost a ton of weight. Yeah, it was hard. I mean, I remember we, like, didn't have a bed. We had, like, a spare room. But I remember we, like, went to IKEA the weekend before to make sure, like, we had a bed for her so she was comfortable.
And she came by herself,
She came by herself, yeah. My dad kept working. You know, his plan was to come after the baby was born. So she was there. And, you know, again, I just remember her being in, like, an extraordinary amount of pain, but she did not complain. She was not a complainer at all. I knew if she was, you know, if she was saying she was in pain, she was really in pain. Yeah.
I would imagine it was also an extraordinary amount of poignancy.
Yeah.
That was going on for everybody.
Right. And maybe that kind of a thing, you know, with adrenaline where it rushes in when you need it the most. For her, perhaps she used that,
emergency
kind of,
mode.
Right.
Yeah.
To be able to be there.
Reach down as deep as you can to get all that strength to be there for you.
Yep.
In that process.
And she was there, and you mentioned she stood for 15 hours, right?
She did. No, I don't know if it's 15. Like, I was probably in labor for 15 hours. She was probably there for 8 of it, and she stood the whole time.
Oh,
and she was there, and yeah, it was amazing. I mean, there was some minor complications with my daughter's birth. So she actually, she was with us, but then she had to be taken to the NICU for a few nights. Just like she had meconium in her, she ingested meconium.
Well, so, you know about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did the same thing. Yeah.
I mean, she was fine and I knew she was going to be fine. But as soon as we got home, I just knew that my mom, she was not doing well. And so
she was in overdrive, I imagine.
She was in overdrive.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
But to be witness to that moment of the birth of your daughter is just so profound.
I mean, she said it was one of the, you know, most special days of her entire life.
It's a circle. It's the circle.
Mm-hmm.
I remember any time I've seen birth or death, they're very similar. They really are. Just backwards.
So what was your mom's relationship with being able to... You know, you mentioned that you guys were able to celebrate when you're in Whistler. She's here for the birth of your daughter. That's an extremely intense emotional experience and really beautiful. And coming from being someone who is a celebratory person and pushing through and doing all this stuff, what was her capacity for nourishment? And you had mentioned a little bit when we spoke before about ways in which you wanted to nourish her because it was so hard for her to eat. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, at this particular moment, like in the story, I mean, we end up bringing home my daughter from the hospital. I think she was there like 2 or 3 nights. And that same day, you know, I remember I have a cousin who lives in New York who worked at Mount Sinai. And I just, it was one of those things, like, I just didn't even know what to do. She didn't have an oncologist here, you know, So we ended up like taking her, she took a cab, I think, because we had to go pick up my daughter from the hospital and ended up putting her in a cab up to Mount Sinai to the emergency room.
Oh, my goodness.
And, I mean, if you've been to the emergency room at Mount Sinai, you know it's not, like, a pleasant place to be. So I think at this point, I think my brother had come up from Washington, D.C., where he lived, and met her there. And she was admitted to the hospital that same day that we took my daughter home. Mm-hmm. So just that feeling in itself of, like, wanting to just celebrate and, you know, be a new mom for the first time, but just being so worried about my own mom.
And the exhaustion of giving birth.
And I mean, at that point, I think you're just, I mean, there's just adrenaline. And but it turned out she had a tumor that was causing her pain, and so the doctor wouldn't let her fly back to Chicago. And so she had surgery here in New York.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, you know, my dad eventually flew in, but then she was here, and she couldn't fly home because she had to recover. So she ended up staying here for, I think, about 2 weeks. And we had really good friends who graciously, they had parents had an extra apartment, you know, a couple blocks from us. So we kind of
helped to make it comfortable.
Yeah, made her comfortable here. And I would, you know, again, it's like that dream. Like, I always dreamed, you know, again, not living in Chicago, I was like having my mom here for the first 2 weeks after I give birth, you know. Yeah. But it really was just about, you know, helping her manage her pain and kind of just distracting her and, you know, bringing my daughter to see her and just, you know, trying to spend as much quality time as I could with her.
You must have had to dig so deep for your own strength during that time.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I think you just do what you have to do. Yes. And again, food, you mentioned food before. I mean, it really, at that point for her, it's not even, I mean, so beyond.
Of course.
Yeah. Like that type of nourishment.
Right. So she was not really probably able to eat much
No,
at all.
Although I do remember, it's funny, I had forgotten this. So my daughter was born, I think, 12 days before Thanksgiving. So by this time, my family had all kind of arrived in New York, and we ended up having Thanksgiving in my apartment in Brooklyn, and I remember making, I think I made like a leg of lamb or something, but you know, I was, to be able to pull that whole meal together after
my
daughter, but you know, again, that's just something that was something important. You know, I think for me, it made me feel a little bit normal.
Totally.
To be able to, you know, get in the kitchen and cook.
And that's for some people.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's for you.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. You had mentioned that she was interested at some point during this process, maybe not right then, but in lemon cake.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was...
Which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, that was, you know, again, for someone who was never really that interested in food, kind of at the very end of her life. So she ended up living like 3 more months after the birth of my daughter. And we had decided that we would go back to Chicago, like as soon as, you know, she had her shot. So it was like 2 months in, to Hosa's baby naming. So my mom, it was like really, it just became this, she became fixated on hosting this big baby naming with all of my family, probably 50 plus people, family and friends in Chicago.
Such purpose and meaning.
Yeah. It really gave her something to look forward to, something to plan for, and so we showed up in Chicago, and, you know, I was really looking forward to, again, spending time with her. But I kind of knew right away that things had taken a turn for the worse. I mean, not just physically, but mentally. You know, she started to say things that didn't really make sense that you almost, like, wanted to laugh at, but then it wasn't funny at all. But
Did you realize that Mom was dying at that time, right?
I think it took a couple days, but I think, yes. I mean, I think that that's when... You know, we finally, and like her on call, you know, it's funny, and there's this disconnect, and I'm sure you've talked to other people about this, where the oncologist and the doctors providing the treatment, kind of once treatment is over, there's never a real conversation about what comes next, and a lot of that is left to the family.
Yeah.
And I think for someone like my mom, who forever associated hospice with dying.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And for someone who never really made peace with the fact that she was dying, never ever wanted to talk about it, it was never a like, we never talked about that. So I think it was, I don't know if it was us coming home and kind of saying, like, look, this is getting a little out of hand. Like,
who do you think said it first when you look back?
I don't remember. I don't know if it was... or my, you know, me talking to my siblings. And I think for me, it was more shocking because, or it was more obvious because I hadn't seen her in a couple months, you know, whereas my dad, who's with her every day, maybe was it, I don't know if he was in denial at that point. But I think within a week of us, you know, kind of me being home, you know, we did bring hospice. And I think that that was really helpful in understanding some of the behaviors and things that were going on. So one of those behaviors was the lemon cake, where she would just wake up in the morning and get these intense cravings for things and just like pour bowls and bowls of cereal, which she never eats.
Wow.
And I, you know, of course I was like, sure, I'll bake a lemon cake if that's what you feel like. But it was kind of this insatiable appetite for sweets. And I learned, you know, after talking to the nurses from hospice, that's a common, you know, thing for someone who's at the very end of their life to kind of start craving sweets.
There's also something called, I actually worked in hospice for 12 years, and there's this, it's called transition, and it's a phase right before death where there's an energy that's not explained that they didn't have before, and it may have come out in the form of that urge for eating.
For eating, and then also planning this party, this baby naming. So all, you know, like she'd wake up in the morning and say, we got to go to Party City and, you know, take me to Costco, like just wanting to run all these errands.
She reminds me, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote a book that was called Live Until We Die. And she was really talking about how if we can do that, if we can actually find a way to find that energy inside, have the people in our life be part of it too, and not say, oh, rest, you should be resting.
Right.
Yeah.
To be able to be who you want to be and live the way you want until the very end.
I mean, she definitely did.
Yeah.
I will say.
It's interesting because you had mentioned earlier when, you know, we were chatting before the show that there's an explanation, a physiological explanation kind of for this craving of sweets, correct?
I think so. I mean, Bobby, you probably know.
The way I remember it, it's more of that burst of energy
right.
that can come out in different forms. But I think there's a biological
right.
thing that's biological thing that's happening in your body.
I think there's a biological thing yeah. too, for sure. And we don't know what it is, but we can figure it out by consulting the internet. But I really do think that it's just so fascinating how those things work in tandem, right? The brain, the heart, and I mean the not the literal brain and heart, but the, you know, your mental state and then your act and your biology versus your spirit. And it's fascinating to me to hear you say that, because it is really about your spirit wanting to just capitalize on like these on these last bits of juiciness.
Well, that's
of
what
life.
I hear about your mom, because for many people, you know, the way when a baby's born, they begin to see more and more and more of the world and they open up. And when someone's dying, and dying is not a moment, it's a process. So generally people are closing in and closing it. But your mom didn't exactly do that. Her spirit seemed that she had such a strong spirit.
Yeah. And she fought.
It shined.
I mean, she had a spirit and she was a fighter. I mean, she really, really fought, you know, till the end. And yeah, she did. And she wanted to live for those moments. And she did. Mm-hmm. I mean, she lived to be there to see my daughter. And she actually lived for the baby naming, even though, you know, she was really, really sick that day. But she was there, and her spirit, for sure,
yes.
was there.
Burning
yeah.
spirit.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the most, like, interesting things that I've ever heard about loss is your story and having a newborn child, the like most amazing kind of addition to your life, and then the biggest loss, losing your mother. And for those things to be happening is so mind-bending, you know, and I'm sure for you too. I'm also wondering if you I'm sure maybe you've thought of this, maybe you haven't, but what do you feel like that experience of losing your mom may have been like had you not had a newborn at the time? Do you feel like there was any
question.
Part of that that actually saved you
in your grief and in her dying?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. And, you know, and my sister and brother certainly, you know, didn't, you know, have the same experience. And I think a lot about that, you know, but they had, you know, different parts of it. Like they, you know, were both single at the time. And so, you know, I had the support of my husband,
yes.
and
sure.
they didn't have that kind of relationship in their life. So they went home, you know, alone. And, you know, they kind of lost my mom knowing that she would never get to meet, you know, their spouse or
yeah.
family or kids. So I think it was that, you know, a feeling of just being so grateful. I also just think, you know, I think... I just always go back to, you know, arriving back in New York, you know, after the funeral, and you just don't have a choice but to go on.
Yeah.
You know, I had someone to wake up and take care of,
yes.
to get up in the middle of the night and feed. It wasn't, you know, my needs and my grieving, like, yes, that's important, but someone else needed me more.
I know that from working, doing many groups, and whether it's the loss of a parent or the loss of a sibling, or the loss of a spouse, when there is a child involved to take care of, it really makes a difference. Because as you say, the focus becomes on the other. And do you think that that delayed your grief, or do you find that it changed your grief by having to focus on your daughter, the new baby, rather than your own feelings?
I don't know if it delayed it. I mean, I think, you know, grief is one of those things everyone just processes it in a different mm-hmm. timeline.
Absolutely.
In
different conditions,
way,
too.
Different conditions, yeah. I mean, in some ways, you know, the fact that I'm, you know, doing this podcast and still talking about it, it's, you know, it's something I'm still processing to this day, and it's
never
been
stopped.
8 years.
We grieve our
yeah.
whole lives.
Yeah.
I also want to mention that today is February 13th, mm-hmm. and this is the 8-year anniversary mm-hmm. of your mom's death, and I asked you, we decided last minute, kind of, that you'd come on the show today. We've been talking for a while, and I didn't know that, and I don't know. It's just kind of incredible. I mean, first of all, thank you for your generosity and your vulnerability and coming on in general. But even more so for picking this day. I hope that it's a special way, in some way, to memorialize your mom and process this whole experience by being in processing. But, you know, really, I mean, I don't know. I just thought that was a very interesting coincidence.
Yeah, no, it is. And I, you know, anniversaries in my family they've always just been a big deal, weddings and birthdays. And, So this day is, you know, it's a day that all of us, you know, my dad and my sister and brother, and I, you know, spoke to my uncle, my mom's brother this morning. You know, it's a day that we'll never forget. And I think that, you know, in the past years, I've tried to take the day, you know, even, you know, I've taken work off a couple years to just really, like, I've just decided, you know, to use this day to do something that I know my mom would love doing. You know, some years I'll go to a museum. She loves museums. Sometimes, you know, I try to do something cultural. I try to do something active. Just as a way to, again, like, kind of celebrate the life, you know, that she led. And when I thought about, you know, when I first reached out to you about the podcast, you know, you're right. It's scary, and it's putting myself out there, and it's sharing a story that's very private and emotional. But I, you know, I just had this sense, like, I knew that she would be really proud. And I knew that this, you know, doing this and sharing the story would, you know, it would make her happy. So
that's amazing. And the smile on your face as you talk about her, you can just feel the love and the warmth that continues always. It's always there. What a day to honor her.
I mean, yeah. I sit here sitting across from Bobby, and I think that Bob, from what you describe about your mom, I think Bobby and I have a similar relationship, you know. And while I did lose my dad, and that was incredibly painful, like, you know, the thought of losing your mom, it's really tough. And you had mentioned, you know, looking at other people with their moms and having a shopping spree, I think you mentioned, which really, I burst into tears when I was reading that. And I mean, 100%, like, full sob. Because I have those thoughts and memories too. And I'm proud of you. So, like, proud of you for having the strength to come on and talk about this, but also just for, and I'm happy for you for having that, that experience of having a kid right away, to be able to, and a daughter, you know, to be able to kind of continue those bonds in this really interesting way. And your strength is really inspirational, and you're just a lovely person. And I'm so grateful that you came to share your story with us, and especially on today of all days.
Oh, thank you.
It's thank really you. Lovely. You wrote something when you were writing, when we were talking earlier, and you're writing some stuff to us about your mom. And I just want to read it back to our listeners, because it was another thing that made me sob. And it's so sweet, and really just really gave me a good picture of who your mom is. And actually, when I was reading it, is advice that I actually really needed to hear at the time. So I can't thank, you know, you and by that way, your mom enough for, you know, saying this and thinking this. But you wrote, "The one piece of advice from my mom I've always carried with me is that the two most important decisions in life are who you choose to be with and what you choose to do and how you do it." And that, for me, paints a really beautiful picture of a really special woman.
She was, and, you know, she had that. She chose my dad, and they had the most incredible, you know, loving marriage and relationship and career together. You know, and a lot of the reasons, you know, my dad pushed my mom to become a therapist. You know, I don't know what she may have done otherwise, but, you know, I had that as a model growing up, and I feel, you know, so incredibly lucky. Now, it's a lot of pressure, though, to look up to them and to kind of see, you know, hold their relationship up.
But it's your foundation.
It is.
It's the bricks that you're built with. It's beautiful.
So we kind of ask everybody, as we're winding down on the show, the same question, which is, if you could give yourself a piece of advice as you're kind of embarking on this journey, it could be really whenever you look at the point when you might have needed advice the most, maybe right after she died or when you learned of her diagnosis, whatever that is for you. But what would be your advice to your former self, to kind of, you know, knowing what you know now, having been through?
Yeah, I guess two things. I mean, I think, like, going through the process of, like, my mom being sick, and, you know, I wish, the one thing I do wish is that we had, I don't know, like, spent more time, like, getting more information from her. I mean, I think that that was the hardest, but it was hard because she never really wanted to sit down and talk about those things.
You, like, had to take her lead.
Yeah, and we did. Yeah. And, like, you know, she wasn't someone who, like, left behind letters or thought about, you know, again, what she would say to my sister on her wedding day or anything like that. And that's okay. And I realize now that, you know, I don't have those letters, but I have saved all, you know, the letters that she wrote us growing up. And
it sounds like she was good in the present.
She was very good.
I thought that she was really a star in the present, and that she didn't want to think that much about the future or the past, and that for her, that's where she lived.
Yeah. So I guess that in itself is a piece of advice: is to whoever the person, we're the ones who are grieving, but as my mom really who was the one who was suffering, and to I guess take the lead, from that person. And every experience is different, and there's no right or wrong. But
that's right. Amen.
Yeah, yeah. And then I think the last thing is on the other end, after you've lost someone, I think someone gave this piece of advice to my sister and I, and I think we've passed it on. But don't be afraid to cry. Tears are okay.
Absolutely. Amen.
I think that
tears are antifreeze for the soul.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a release, and it's okay, and to let those tears come and to feel that sadness. And
I love that. And I also want to and that with saying that if someone else is crying, don't be afraid of their tears,
Make space, make room.
Even a stranger. Sometimes I'll see somebody crying on the street, and just to make eye contact and be are you okay?
Think about the concept of making room, because we do that with our own feelings. We tighten up around them.
Yeah.
And the more that we open up, we can fully process them. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's the same thing for other people. If we can make more room, it gives them the chance to process them too.
Yeah.
Without judgment, with compassion.
Yeah. Well, this was a really amazing talk, and just thank you. It never fails to amaze me how people are so generous with their time and so generous in saying, hey, I have a story, and my story's painful, and it's painful to sit here and recant the worst thing that happened in my life. I think the goal and the benefit of doing such and of being so generous with your time and your emotions is that there are other people out there who are listening to this who are like, oh my God, I'm in a family where we're not allowed to talk about emotions, or I didn't think it was okay to cry, or, I'm struggling, I'm suffering, I'm hurting, this happened to me, and just
even
that
though
connection.
It might be a different story, one little pearl.
Yeah.
One little pearl.
Right.
And for everybody out there, thank you so much for sharing your depth and the story of your mom and your family and the love that you all share. And I know there are so many pearls there.
Yeah. It makes it, the point I guess I want to make, it really makes a difference.
Yeah.
So for as hard as it can be to talk about it, I think it really makes a difference to other people. We get this small, unknown sliver of time in this world, and so much of it can be painful and fucked up and unfair, So for each and every one of us to do anything to make that time less brutal or alienating or alone for other people is really kind and compassionate. And, it's really kind and compassionate of you to come on and talk about your mom. And she sounded like a really wonderful woman.
Yes. Yeah.
And you paint such a in your writing and our conversations before this, you really painted such a beautiful picture of her. And through this conversation, you really did too. And I just get the perception of a really warm, present, exciting, unique, special, vivacious woman.
Yes. Yeah.
And so you've done her an incredible honor by, telling anyone with an iPhone who can listen to this podcast about how amazing your mom was.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, you guys, I've listened to your other podcasts, and I keep thinking how lucky that the two of you are to be able to do something like this together. And get people to tell their stories and touch so many other people's lives. So thank you for having me.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Bobby always says, she always quotes Viktor Frankl and says, survival is a community event. And I think that that's really what the whole goal of this is, right? So each time we speak with somebody else and each time there's another listener, it's really kind of about building a community of people who are grief sucks. It's so hard. And yet we are in it together.
It's inevitable.
And we'll all do it. And let's just fucking talk about it,
Exactly.
Let's just talk about it, because it happens and we don't need to sweep it under the rug. So thanks for helping us do that. You're amazing, and it was so nice to talk to you, and we can't wait for everyone to hear your episode.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
thank you
so much. Okay, bye. Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.